This is Positive Parenting. Parenting expertise and advice from best-selling parenting author and national newspaper columnist, Mr. Dad, Armin Brott.
Hello and welcome to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott. We all feel it. As connectivity encroaches into every corner of our lives, it has all sorts of unintended consequences, and a lot of them are kind of for the worse. But as we worry about the effect of connectivity on our privacy, on our ability to focus on our work and our families, on our friendships and on important relationships, and even on, well, our sanity, we all recognize that we still don't want to give up the convenience or the advantages of connectivity either. What we need to do is establish healthy boundaries for technology. Well, that, of course, is easier said than done. But fortunately, our guest for this part of today's show is the author of a book called Boundaries in an Overconnected World. So if you've ever wanted to protect yourself in cyberspace or on the phone, or you think you need to learn to rule as opposed to be ruled by your smartphone, your computer, and other devices, or if you want to make the most of connectivity while minimizing the dangers and distractions, or you just want to stay safe, protected, and connected in ways that genuinely matter, you're not going to want to miss this show, because by the end of it, you're going to have a really good handle on how to set limits on intrusions and exposure in cyberspace with every communication device you own and with everyone who wants to reach you through them. And in the second part of today's show, we're going to be continuing our series on organizations and programs that are of special interest to military families. We're going to be speaking with one of the Army's top resiliency trainers and a gentleman who's going to tell us an awful lot about online learning networks. All that and a lot more is coming up in today's Positive Parenting.
I walk and you drive. So let's make a deal. I'll watch for you and cross the street safely. You watch for me and stop. Think of the impact we can make.
A message from the Federal Highway Administration.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott, and my guest for this part of today's show is Anne Catherine, who's the author of Boundaries in an Overconnected World, Setting Limits to Preserve Your Focus, Privacy, Relationships, and Sanity. Anne, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
I like the "and sanity" part.
Yes.
Which is something that gets lost in the shuffle all too often.
Too much, yes.
Talk about the kind of boundaries that you're talking about and how it is that we seem to be missing them.
There are maybe 1,000 issues that have been created by the increased use of the internet and digital devices. And the answer to most of these is to set boundaries. So, for example, take authority over your time, your energy, and your life. Protect your personal information. Set limits on texting, email, forwards, and time online. Protect your focus. Protect your safety. These are all places where you can be setting boundaries and getting your life back.
Do you think that everybody recognizes, or that enough people recognize, that they have gotten rid of the boundaries or ignored the boundaries or slowly let the internet and other technological things kind of creep in and settle themselves into our life?
I think it's been an avalanche of new devices, new enticements on the internet, and we're so busy just taking it all in and figuring out how to use everything that we haven't had the time to stop and take stock and check, does this hurt my life or not? Or have we just been carried away by it? So I think a lot of people have been carried away, and they're feeling the effects. As I'm on different shows throughout America, I'm encountering people who just feel snowed under. Can't keep up, feel guilty about it, trying the best they can. But they're having other losses in their lives.
Well, let's talk about that. What are some of the ways that the lack of boundaries is affecting us?
With people of all ages losing opportunities to bond and reconnect for a variety of reasons, and losing time with the family because they've run into the computer to do one thing, and then either because they were interrupted 30 times or because something pulled their attention over here and then something else pulled their attention over there, that 10 minutes turned into 3 hours, and family time was lost. Time to exercise.
Yep.
Sitting at the computer so many hours, which is actually harmful for the body. And lots of losses for children that set them up to not have intimacy skills when they get older.
You know, I was sitting at a restaurant with my daughters, who were 20 and 23 not long ago, and it was just the three of us, which was kind of a nice thing.
Very nice.
And I pointed their attention to a table next to us where there were six people roughly their age, maybe a little older, and all six of them had their heads down, and from a distance you might have thought they were all praying or something, but every single one of them was texting or checking email or something, and I pointed that out to them thinking, you know, is this what's really going on in the world, that you've got all these people sitting next to each other, but they're somewhere else?
Mm-hmm. Not fully there. What did they answer?
Well, they I was sort of expecting them to text me something, but you know, they said, yeah, that looks pathetic, I think was the response.
Oh, what a great response. I'd be dancing. In Northern California, I was sitting on top of a beautiful old historic hotel, fall colors in the mountains, absolutely beautiful. Father and two teenage girls was sitting at the next table. I don't think I ever heard the father say a word, neither did the girls. They were each on their individual phones. So they're in the midst of this beauty and not interacting with each other. Sometimes people are texting each other when they're sitting in the same room.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and that sort of becomes a joke, I guess, to some extent, or it becomes certainly the stuff of television commercials. But
yeah,
how do you get across to people who may not even be aware? I mean, I'm sure that some of those six people who are sitting at the table next to us, just they would say, oh, yeah, it was so cool. We spent I got together with my friends. We spent a really great time at this restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
But they're looking at it in a way that from the outside it looks very different. So, I mean, I would say they were there. Again, they were there, but not really there.
Mm-hmm.
But how do you explain to them that there's a problem? Or is it one of these situations where it's not really a problem unless it somehow negatively affects your life in a way that you can perceive?
Well, as rampant as it is, I think it is a problem. And the thing about people of all ages, we don't know what we don't know. So it gives parents and grandparents a charge to give those kids a chance to experience what they don't know they're missing, like setting family times that are digital-free, computers off, and fill that time with interaction, face-to-face, communication, having discussions, playing games together, doing things that the kids are interested in together without machines.
It really is a situation of swimming upstream, I think, for a lot of parents, is that there is so much weight behind social media, and everything is social media these days.
Yes.
You have to have a blog, and you have to tweet, and Facebook, and Instagram, and Vine, and everything else. I mean, we've kind of gotten down to Vine, for those who don't know it, 6-second videos, that's it. Kind of gotten down to, we can't even handle 10 seconds if we need 6 seconds. It's just so overwhelming.
It is.
And so addictive at the same time it's so hard, I think, as a parent to fight against that. How do you do that without losing your kids' respect completely? Because they're going to say, well, look, this is what everybody's doing it.
Well, we parents have had to deal with that question for centuries. The others are playing with the dinosaurs. Why can't I? So it's just one of the tough aspects of being a parent is that there is a way parents end up swimming upstream, especially with whatever the current adolescent fad is. But this one, I think, is more dangerous because this is the one where kids learn interpersonal skills. So it's first start small, and you can even get the kids involved with the problem that, you know, we got a problem here. I don't know if you've noticed, but this isn't happening, and it's my job to prepare you for a full life, and I know that having a full life means that certain skills have to be practiced. So Do you guys have suggestions? I have some suggestions. Does anybody else realize there's a problem? So one thing is just to have this family get together with all of the vices gone. And that's one option. Another option is in one of the chapters in my book, I have discussion questions and links to discussion questions that you can use for starting conversations with your kids about all manner of things that happen on the Internet. And then I also talk there about what I think is the number one important parenting skill, which is attunement, and how important attunement is, which gives you, when you practice attunement with your kids, it gives you a line into what matters the very most to them. And once you know what that is, you can figure out how to use that in the service of family times.
Isn't the response going to be, though, oh, yeah, you want me to have a full life? Well, a few generations ago, the definition of full life was learning to speak Greek and riding side saddle or something. I mean, or, mm-hmm. you know, roping calves or something. You know, and times have changed, Mom and Dad. We don't need that anymore. How do you respond to that kind of thing?
Well, my first response would be, that's a great idea. Let's go to a ranch. But after I got over that, I would say that if the carrot isn't working, not to use a stick, of course, but set a time, and it could start out at 15 minutes. It doesn't have to sound like infinity to them. It could just be 15 minutes. That's digital free, and let's say one of your kids wants to be a surgeon. Then find some way to bring that into it, like visiting, this may be a bad example, but visiting a surgeon or talking to a surgeon or going to watch a surgery or whatever, or watching something on TV and then turning off the TV and then talking about it afterwards. So it doesn't even matter too much what the subject is. What matters is the interaction.
Anne Catherine is the author of Boundaries in an Overconnected World, Setting Limits to Preserve Your Focus, Privacy, Relationships, and Sanity. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk some more. Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott, continuing our discussion, in case you're just joining us, with Anne Catherine, who's the author of Boundaries in an Overconnected World, Setting Limits to Preserve Your Focus, Privacy, Relationships, and Sanity. Wanted to get a little bit to the issue of protection. Talked about some of the many different ways that social media is affecting us and taking our time away. But there's also kind of besides the time, there's the sinister aspect of intrusions into our life, things that we aren't even aware of, the information gathering that's so rampant out there, and people just click sure, or they submit their private information, or they click all the way to the end of the user agreements without really reading the whole thing and finding out that if the companies are being honest, and a lot of them aren't, but that they're planning to use the information that you give them to sell you more stuff.
Mm-hmm.
How do you begin to, first of all, as an adult, figure out what's going on and how these things are endangering us or intruding on our lives, and figuring out what we need to do to protect it? And then how do we help protect the family?
Well, for one thing, know that anything that you, any place you go on the Internet, the likelihood is great that you will be tracked, that website will plant in your computer a tracker that will then record every place you go from then on, what you do there, and send it back to some big company that then brokers it to lots of other companies, so that an average number of trackers planted in your computer by one visit to one website is 60. So if you go to 10 websites in a day, you're going to carry around 600 trackers.
Wow.
And
I had no idea.
Yeah, yeah. Now, there's something you can do about that. You can set your computer to dump the trackers at the end of every day. You can also set it to not receive trackers. It'll slow you down. And so one decision everyone makes for themselves is where they want to be on the boundary continuum. One end is convenience, the other end is safety.
Well, how do you end up just going with the first option, with setting your computer to dump the trackers.
That's one of the things that's in one of the chapters about what you look for on your own computer to find the place where you can make those settings. And
Where is that? What is that?
Well, the browser you use is where you would start. That you would go to preferences, you would choose security or privacy. And good browsers give you the option of rejecting trackers. And next best browsers give you the option of dumping all the trackers at the end of the day. Now, what that means is that nobody will know your password. You're going to have to enter all that information every time. So that's where the less convenience comes in.
Oh, so that's the you're kind of equating trackers and cookies, though, in a lot of ways.
Well, there are cookies, but there are a whole list of things that can be planted in your computer. For example, when you go to your bank, when you leave your bank, first of all, always sign out. After you sign out, close that tab on your browser. After you do that, close the browser. And if you have set it to dump trackers at the end of your session, then also restart your computer. And then all the trackers will be gone, and you turn it back, and it comes back on. And then you go to the next place, and you don't have anybody reporting back to some big company in the sky.
Wow.
Almost every time you agree, you know, you can't finish that order unless you check the I agree to your terms and conditions. In the service of this book, I spent way too many hours reading every word of those terms and conditions over and over again. And what they basically do is leave enough holes in it that they could drive a truck through. So that in the end, what they're really saying is, I'm going to use your information any way I can to make a buck. They've left themselves plenty of options.
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
You can't use the thing or buy the little widget unless you check that box. So you're giving them permission, and that's why we have to take charge of what we let them do to our computers.
And how do you go about then educating the kids about this or the importance of it? Because it seems, I think it seems probably to a lot of adults, oh, what's the harm in it, for God's sake? It's just you're checking a box, and what are they going to do with the information anyway?
Well, anything they want.
Well,
they've
yeah,
got a profile of you. They know your spending habits, your buying power. They know you like red. They know you like to do do-it-yourself projects. If you notice that the longer you're on the Internet, the more the ads are targeted to your interests, that's no accident. That's that compilation of information they've already gathered. I got an email. I'll answer your question in a second. I got an email from one company that's very reputable and stayed saying, oh, you haven't read our newsletter yet. Well, how'd they know that? They had a tracker in the email, and they knew whether I clicked on the newsletter. And they knew, they would have known if I had clicked on the newsletter. They would have known everything I read and the things I didn't, and if I'd have forwarded it to my cousin. They know what we're doing. So how you get it across to kids? Well, the kids today aren't, it's obvious they don't have a sense of where their privacy boundaries should be. They're seeing way too much online. And I don't know if they can't think largely enough to realize it's going to everybody who's interested, like somebody in Singapore that you wouldn't want to be on the same train with, or nothing against Singapore, it's just an example, far away, people can know everything that you're saying. And they might not be so aware that the consequences are that will be there forever, and if they want to apply for a job with the FBI in 20 years, the FBI will Google everything they've ever done.
And it'll all be there. Yeah.
To find it.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that'll make an impression, but one thing you can do is monitor and track everything your kids are doing. There are free programs that you can use, and there are very inexpensive programs you can use. Those are all in one of the chapters.
Mm-hmm.
So that you can see what they're doing, what email they're getting, what websites they're visiting, and suss out if they're getting themselves into danger.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the interpersonal things that are going on. I mean, certainly there's chat groups, but I think I saw the statistic a couple of weeks ago, or maybe it might have even been longer ago than that, about, I guess it's like 1 in 5 relationships or 1 in 5 marriages starts online. That's a lot.
That's an awful lot.
And how so? And there's all these ads you can't turn on TV or the radio or anything without hearing from eHarmony or Match.com or any of the other ones. And, and I'd say probably a 20% of the spam that I get is some sort of dating site for various age groups or races or religions. How do you separate out? I mean, certainly you're going to have to part with some personal information if you're going to engage with somebody, not necessarily engage to get married, but just engage to speak with.
Right.
So how do you know? How can you check out whether the person on the other end of the computer is a real person or is who he or she claims to be?
Let me just say about that, about online dating, that you are forced to end up giving them a whole lot of personal information. Information they don't need to have to match you with somebody. I'll just say that. And if you don't give that information, you can't complete their application form. It's important. Two things are important. Three, at least. I have a step-by-step process, of course, but the highlights on the process are, first, move with some dispatch toward actually seeing the person in person, because anybody can make anything up and they can put any picture they want. And then second, meet that person in a very populated place in an area you never go to and get there really early so that you're first there. But the third is the most important thing, and that is, if at any point in this process you get a red flag, something that gives you pause, stop right there.
Oh, that's
so hard.
Don't make
excuses. Don't talk yourself. If you find yourself either making excuses for the person or talking yourself into something, stop. Something's wrong, and some part of your body is picking up on it. Respect it.
Tough thing to do. I think probably anybody who's been divorced will be able to say that they did exactly the opposite of that. They disregarded some red flag in the very beginning. Yeah. Ann Catherine is the author of Boundaries in an Overconnected World, Setting Limits to Preserve Your Focus, Privacy, Relationships, and Sanity. Ann, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you, Armin, for inviting me.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott. It's time for another Parents at Play segment. And with us, as usual, is Sam Fuse. Sam, how are you?
We're doing good. How are you doing?
Well, I'm all right. And I'm going to talk about something. So I want you to stay awake for this. I know you don't like chess and you don't like board games. But there were a couple of really interesting games that are from a distance. I mean, if you stood a little bit away, you would say, oh, those are chess games. But they're actually not. Are you still awake there?
I'm trying really hard. I'm just kidding. I'm awake.
Okay. So the first one is called ARIMA. I'm not quite sure. It has two A's at the end, A-R-I-M-A-A. And it's really an interesting game. There's a whole ton of explanation on their website, which is ARIMA.com. The basic object of the game is that there are more powerful pieces and less powerful pieces.
And is it like Game of Thrones? We got like the Khaleesi popping out?
No. It's not like that at all. It's complicated, but in a nice sort of friendly sort of way. It takes you a little while to get to know the game. But imagine a chess game. Instead of having all the pawns in the front to try to protect the king, what you are trying to do is have the powerful pieces protect the weaker ones. And the way that you remove pieces from the board is if your elephant steps on the other guy's horse, and the elephant being a more powerful creature than the horse, then out goes the horse.
And a little Robin Hood.
A little bit.
We're teaching a little bit of ethics here.
Yeah,
okay,
I mean, exactly.
That the
more powerful ones have a responsibility to look out for the least powerful ones.
Social responsibility. Now you've got me listening. I'm awake now. Fully awake, paying attention.
Okay. Well, that's good. I didn't realize this. I thought that chess was a difficult game, involves a lot of strategy. And one of the most interesting things about ARIMA is you can set up your board any way you want, as long as your 16 pieces are in the two rows that are closest to you. So it looks kind of like a chess setup, but you could put your pieces any different way that you want to. So in chess, there are really, for example, only about 30 moves at any time. I think it's about 20 if you to open up the game. You have 20 possibilities. But with Arima, at any given point, you have 17,000 possible moves, which is just unbelievably
Do you need to be an accountant or a chemical engineer to be able to play this game?
No, you don't. And you can play it on all different sorts of levels. It really, it's great for a one-on-one kind of a game. This is really not a two-to-four player game usually, although they say you can play it with two to four, but that's just kind of teams. It's usually better for one-on-one.
I see that you've said the rules are easy enough for 5 or 6-year-olds to learn. I'm already a little bit intimidated. Do you really believe that my 5-year-old could figure this out?
I'm going to explain it to him. He can explain it to you.
That's fair enough.
Okay.
That's fair enough.
So
you just challenged him, though. That's really unfair.
So the other one that I wanted to talk about is a little bit different also. It's Commander-in-Chief is the name of the game. And if you look at the board, it's kind of like a chessboard, but it has a blue stripe down the middle of it. And you play the game with the chessboard on an angle, so it looks like a diamond as you're setting it up. And the blue stripe in the middle is the ocean, and there are land masses on each side. And this is more like chess, is that each individual piece has its own moves. There are helicopters that can go over water, but they can't go over land. And there's certain pieces that can go over land, but they can't go in the water, and some that can go in both. And then there's submarines, and each piece has its own specific way of moving and specific way of capturing. And what's nice is that this is a little bit harder. So each player has a set of rules, a card that has all the moves on it until you really get to know the thing. But it's a nice twist on chess, and it's really a lot of fun. I played it a couple times with my 10-year-old, and she absolutely loved it. And I think part of the reason she loved it was that the pieces, the helicopters or the jets or the tanks and the amphibian vehicles and all that kind of stuff, they're beautifully made. So it's really nice to hold them in your hand. They've got weight, and they're just really, the detail is fantastic.
So this is kind of like a game of war meets chess.
It is kind of like that. Yeah, I mean, chess is really all about a military strategy anyway, and you're protecting the king. And so in this one, you're protecting the commander-in-chief, but you're doing it in a much, much different way than you would with your rooks and your knights and your bishops.
Well, that sounds like a lot of fun. I'm a little intimidated, honestly, not being a master strategist or player of board games, but it does look interesting, and you did pique my interest, and
yeah.
I stayed awake the whole time.
Thank you. And again, you really don't have to be a master of chess. I mean, these are separate games altogether, but they're played on the same board, so I was thinking that these are kind of fun alternatives to chess or to augment your chess playing skills. And you can get the longer reviews of these particular games, which we're calling Beyond the Game of Kings, at parentsatplay.com. And you can get a lot of our other reviews there as well. For Sam Fuse, I'm Armin Brott. Welcome back to the second part of today's Positive Parenting Show on AFN. I'm Armin Brott. In our first segment, we're going to be speaking with Master Sergeant Jennifer Laredo, who is a Master Resiliency Trainer for the U.S. Army. Tell us a little bit about what does a Master Resiliency Trainer do?
So a Master Resilience Trainer is somebody who is taught and trained 14 resilience skills in a 10-day curriculum that they in turn go back to their organization or unit in the Army and train those skills to soldiers. So during the 10 days, for the first several days, they're the student. They're learning these resilience skills, these life skills. And then the second portion of the training is them actually acting as the teacher or the trainer of these skills and practicing teaching them to others, enhancing their depth of knowledge, responding to questions, things of that nature.
Is this one of the other speakers was Dr. Gordon, who mentioned something I thought was really interesting, that he felt that it should be taught up front rather than after the fact. Is that something that the Army is doing as far as getting the recruits and giving them some resilience training in boot camp or slightly afterwards?
Yeah, so Comprehensive Soldier and Family Fitness, which is the program that Master Resilience Trainers fall under, is all about It's a preventive program, and we have Master Resilience trainers teach resilience skills in all Army schools, starting in basic training all the way through the War College. There's different amounts of training depending on what the course is, but we are really working hard to teach soldiers these skills upon entering the military. It's not something that you really just learn once. It's, you know, repetitive over time. Reinforcing the skills is the approach that we use, and there's plenty of evidence to show that it's working.
Do you have to have any kind of specialized psychology background, or you're taking the course is just the way that it is? Because you said you were the student in the beginning and then you become the teacher. So where does it all change?
Right. So you don't have to have any type of psychology major or degree to be a Master Resilience Trainer. For the most part, MRTs, Master Resilience Trainers, are non-commissioned officers. We're already trainers anyways. And we kind of want the MRT to be somebody who's an informal leader who can relate to the soldiers in their organization and, you know, teach these skills in a way that the audience can relate to. There are also family members that we're training as Master Resilience Trainers and some Department of the Army civilians, but across the board, there's no prerequisite for any type of psychology degree or background. As a matter of fact, it might be better that you don't have that.
Then you bring just the real world stuff. You mentioned that they're mostly NCOs. So are you training officers as well, or are they getting that someplace else?
Yes, we do train officers as Master Resilience Trainers. All soldiers receive resilience training, but I was just trying to say that for the most part, MRTs are non-commissioned officers. So for the most part, it's like staff sergeants and sergeants first class, some master sergeants.
Okay, so you came to this from probably an unexpected place, right? You were not intending to be a Master Resilience Trainer, I imagine, right? So can you tell us just a little bit about your story?
So in 2010, I was actually a first sergeant at Fort Bragg and was married to Eddie Laredo, Staff Sergeant Laredo, who was an infantryman. And we both were deployed to Afghanistan around the same time. He left, you know, quite a bit before I did, but there was overlapping time. We were both in Afghanistan. And shortly before he redeployed and shortly after I had gotten there, he was killed by an IED. About 6 weeks after I arrived in Afghanistan, I was notified that he had been in an accident. He had lost his left leg and was in surgery when I was notified by my commander. And so they got me to where he was as quickly as possible. And unfortunately, he had already passed when I got there. So obviously, a spiral of events occurred after that. But to answer your question, did I ever anticipate being an MRT? Absolutely not. After we lost my husband, I took a little bit of time off. And when I went back to work, I was really trying to figure out where I fit in as a soldier, as an Army leader, now that I wasn't going to go back to Afghanistan with my soldiers. I was exploring, trying to work with other surviving families and just try to use my experiences in some sort of positive way. And the installation I was assigned to, Fort Bragg, was standing up the CSF2 Comprehensive Soldier and Family Fitness Program, and basically asked me to be a part of that. It was literally a few months after my husband died. I think it was about 6 months after he died, I was sent to the course. And most people, the light kind of turns on and they're all gung-ho about the course after about day two or three. But for me, it kind of had a different effect. It was just continuously reminding me of escorting my husband's body back and just, you know, the horrible events that I had recently experienced. So it took me a little bit longer to jump on board. But once I did, I quickly realized that I was in this position for a very good reason, and I was going to do my best to pay the program forward.
What was your MOS before?
I'm a dental assistant, so I'm still a dental assistant. Yeah, 19 years enlisted, 68 echo dental assistant, and I still am. But my primary duty now is master resilience trainer.
So you had had some of the resilience training before you became a trainer?
No, I had actually never heard of the program. I didn't know what master resilience trainers were. It was quite interesting how it all came about and didn't make sense at first, like I said. But I obviously am one of the right people for the job. So,
but this only happened 3 years ago, right? So, because you said you had a five-year-old son and he was two at the time. Has there just been that much change in the Army that they're really gearing up and making sure that everybody gets that training? So it just wasn't available before?
Actually, the program started in 2009. And so if you think about it, we were really ramping up for deployment and focusing on what our mission was going to be in Afghanistan. So the program had been in existence for probably about a year, but just like anything that's going to touch the entire Army, it takes a little bit of time to get down to the lowest levels. So about a year later was when I was first introduced to it, and here I am.
So, excuse me, you're still continuing to do the dental assistant, so you have, you're not, oh, I thought you said you were still doing it. Okay.
It's my MOS, but I don't actually do it, if that makes any sense. So a master resilience trainer has an additional skill identifier, and so my primary MOS is still and always will be dental assistant, but my ASI is master resilience trainer, and that's what I do full-time now.
Okay, that clears it up. I thought it'd be a terrible thing to have two completely different jobs like that. So you had some very nice messages for families who maybe are in a Gold Star or a Blue Star situation as you were, or just maybe not. Maybe they're just dealing with just the regular issues of PCSing all over the place. And so how do you begin to talk to people, and how do you encourage them to come see you?
Right. Well, I mean, first of all, like I said, CSF2 and the resilience training that we provide as MRTs is really targeted as a proactive type of approach. So we teach life skills to people so that when they experience some type of event or adversity, then they can apply one or some of the skills to help them bounce back from that adversity. I don't always tell people my personal story right away. But if and when I do, I think it's important for people to know that the skills that we teach are, they could be applied to a tragedy such as mine, but I think they're more targeted at our everyday type of events that sort of stress us out or bring us down. You know, it could be anything from an argument that you get in with a spouse or a loved one to, you know, getting a parking ticket. I mean, it could be a myriad of things, but the goal is that once you do experience a traumatic event, that you have these skills within yourself, in your toolbox, that you can apply to be stronger on the other end.
Are you training, you said you're training family members, but so that means the civilians? Is that something that's just routinely offered to civilians, or do they have to come in and specifically ask for it?
Right. So, first of all soldiers are required to be trained on all of the skills every year. There's no mandatory requirement for family members or civilians at this point, but the Army has directed that there be a goal of one family member MRT per company and one DA civilian MRT per 250 civilians. So depending on the command and what their mission is, the senior commander will dictate how often or when those specific audiences receive resilience training, but it is a program for not just soldiers, but families and civilians as well.
So if a family member or a service member decides that they would like to get a little bit more counseling, that they want a refresher on the 14 skills, or they're having trouble with something, do they go through chaplains, or is how do they get in touch with additional resources?
As far as an MRT is concerned, so like I said, there's the goal, the directive is one MRT per company. So it should be pretty obvious within an organization who the MRT is. And if somebody has received the training and they need a refresher or have some questions, then it really should be as simple as just pulling that person to the side. If they don't know or they don't have a company MRT, then there should be one at the battalion and brigade level as well. And then Army Community Service, ACS, they have MRTs at every installation. And we're working towards one CSF2 program manager per installation. So there's really MRTs. We've trained almost 20,000 Army-wide to date. I can't imagine it would be too hard to find one. If all else fails, they can go to our website, which is www.csf2.army.mil, and send our office an email, and we can help put them in touch with somebody.
Well, I was kind of thinking, as I was asking you the question, thinking about Guard and Reserve folks who may be way far away from other places. They aren't on a base. There may be in their mind a battalion or brigade level something, but it's way, way far away. So how do they get to you?
Yeah, so the National Guard and the Army Reserves obviously have different challenges than the active component. There is still a target of one MRT per company, but a lot of times they are geographically dispersed. And so it's really up to that commander to decide. Maybe they need more than one MRT per company. Every state has a state resilience coordinator. So if the family member or soldier in the National Guard or Reserves isn't sure who it is in their organization, they could always contact that state resilience coordinator.
Jennifer Laredo, thank you very much. Master Sergeant Jennifer Laredo, Master Resilience Trainer with the United States Army. I'm here with Stephen Judd, who's with the University of New Hampshire Extension Program and is doing some really interesting stuff with online learning networks. And tell us about that, Stephen.
Well, what we're doing is we're working with people to help them sort of develop comfort with the tools that are necessary to operate in online environment. And the reason that that's important is because, particularly in today's world where we're geographically dispersed and not able to connect in person because of schedules and other things, an online environment provides a great opportunity to form a virtual community that would provide you people that you can learn from, that you can share with, and places where you can go to find resources that can help you with issues that you may have.
So many people are already doing online stuff. I mean, everybody's got a Facebook page and everybody's got a Twitter handle. And so you're talking about things that are more structured than just throwing everything up on your Facebook page?
I think a lot of it's about trying to get people to be a little bit more mindful about how they're using their networks and sort of what their purpose is. So I may use Facebook just to keep in touch with family and friends. And that's a great use of that as a true social network. But I may also want to be using my networks to learn more, doing professional development or just learning about a new subject, learning about cooking, whatever it happens to be that I'm interested in the moment, or accessing resources that could be of use to me, you know, as a military personnel or military family. There are a lot of online resources, but finding them and connecting to them and knowing which ones are trustworthy can be hard. And so by using your networks in that way, I think it's slightly different than just the way kids may start using Facebook in high school And it's a matter of how do we nurture that and be mindful about how we're using our network so that we can get the most benefit from them.
Okay, so how do you do that? How do you begin to figure out that you want to go beyond Facebook and you want to do something? Because you know, so much of our audience, they're overseas, and they're going to be doing a lot of connecting and with people back home, and resources are going to be important to find. So how do you say, here's what's out there?
Well, I think it's still always going to be about people. And so each person needs to think about what they want to use their network for. And personally, I use different networks for different purposes. So I use Facebook primarily, again, as a way to stay in touch with family, friends, neighbors, and the like. Whereas I may use another social network like Twitter that's more for me about a place for me to share information and to get information from people that I'm interested in. And so...
But those are not as effective as learning places, right? I mean, those are mostly kind of outbound information, outbound communication, saying, hey, here's what's going on. I just did this, or my baby just took the first two steps or something. But you're talking about using these networks for go beyond that, to actually learn things or to improve yourself or to deal with stressful situations.
Right, and some of it is just getting information. So there's an information gathering process and trying to be in the flow of that information so that you can get what you need when you need it. But to me, a lot of it, the learning process is about making sense of all that information that you receive and then sharing it back. So Twitter's very limited, right? It's 140 characters, and so people, what can I do? You can do some... work there to develop a learning network of your own. But you can also use tools like Facebook, LinkedIn, Google+, a variety of places where through that process of connecting with people, having discussions, so again, some tools are better than Twitter for that, you can actually make those connections and learn in the process and develop a network of people that you trust and that you can come to rely on in the future.
So the first step is going to be to say, this is what I want to do. Do you work with people to sort of have a pre-first step to figure out what it is that they really need? Because people may not know that things are out there, so it's one of these things, you know, you don't know what you don't know. So how do they even figure out that, oh yeah, that would be so cool if I could?
You know, I have not really developed a tried and true technique to help people with that because... like you said, everyone's different. And so what I find is that my needs are unique and that they change and they're constantly in flux. So I'm using these networks in different ways. And what we're trying to encourage people to do is think about, even if it's just a small need that you might have, maybe your one interest right now is I need to figure out how to make freeze ahead meals for my family because, you know, we have X, Y, and Z going on. And focus on that and build up a network where you can pull those resources, find people you trust. And a lot of times that's people you know in person, and start there and then branch out into some of the technologies and through doing searches and looking at who gives reliable advice. Then you can develop a network, and then as your interests change, your network is going to change.
You mentioned kind of being able to filter through and figure out what's appropriate, what's not appropriate. And that's one of the most frustrating things as a parent myself and just as a human being. You know, you get online, you get on Google or you get on Bing or something, and you're just bombarded. I mean, you do the simplest search and you're going to get 312 million hits. And how do you know? And you know, kids in high school are being taught now, you cannot just look at the first four things that come up. You have to go beyond that. So do you have sort of a blanket approach to how you can filter out the crap from the good stuff?
Well, for me, the first part is finding people and organizations that you do trust and looking at the information that they reference or link to. So that's the use of a curator, someone intermediate, that is taking the time to really vet those resources. And then beyond that, it gets involved in trying to figure out what motivation would people have. So if you're on a .gov site or a .mil site, you can feel, or a .edu site, you may feel more comfortable that these resources are reliable. But if you go on a site and it's really not clear who put that up there, and there's not an About Us page, and it doesn't link back to anything, then you start to get suspicious. And sometimes just Googling review of this page will give you that kind of information.
Well, plus if they have prominently displayed a place to pay as opposed to a place to get some information, yeah.
Right. And, you know, for me, I try and use sort of a imaginary sliding scale. So there's some information that to me, it's not critical that it's really the perfect, most accurate information. You know, I don't necessarily need the atomic weight of oxygen to the 100th place. But then there's other information when I'm thinking about my personal finances, or I'm thinking about retirement planning, or, you know, pick your poison, that I really want to be a lot more careful of. So I don't think people should be discouraged and say, oh, I can't trust anything I read. You need to think about how important is this and how much impact would it have if I choose wrong and this information is wrong. And at those times, you want to be especially careful and really think about, are there places you already trust that you can go to that will refer you back to that information, that they've already looked at it?
So it really is, whether it's online or not, it's pretty much the same stuff, as you want to go to trusted people, first of all, to get some sort of vetting. I mean, we're talking about a military audience here, and they're often preyed upon by all sorts of unscrupulous people who are taking advantage of the fact that, that one person is away and somebody else is at home who's frazzled and doesn't know stuff or may not be quite as familiar with, you know, there's all these like car things, you know, that you can buy a car, but then you realize after you've bought the car that you have huge balloon payments or something. And so being able to filter through that stuff or find a website that says, stay away from these kinds of things, or here's what you need to do if you're buying a car, and it's also not necessarily going to be only on a .mil or .gov. There can be some .coms as well that can be reliable.
Yes, definitely. And I think that's part of it, is understanding who you can trust. You know, is it the Better Business Bureau that you can go to? Is it Military One Source that you go to? And where in between? As you said, just because someone is a commercial entity and is making money doesn't mean they're not trustworthy. It just means that they also have an additional motivation for you to do something. And you need to consider whether that's going to influence the advice that they give you or the information that they share with you. And it comes back to the real world, right? We always, you know, we've always had to make decisions, and we've relied on getting information from people we know and people we trust. Because, you know, just because the salesman said this is the best deal you were ever going to get didn't mean you didn't go and ask your dad, hey, you know, what do you think? And the same is true in online environments. You may not have that same personal relationship with the person, but over time in interactions, you'll grow to develop a trust for someone. And if they recommend a resource, you feel more comfortable that it's actually valid.
So tell us just in a couple of minutes, or as fast as you can, what exactly you're doing at the University of New Hampshire, and how is that playing into all of this?
So I work with a national extension initiative, and we have a community of practice around network literacy, and it's really designed to help mostly professionals, whether they be people who work for universities and for extension or military family service professionals, become more comfortable in operating in these kinds of environments for the sake of their own personal learning, their professional development, also how they can help educate other people in that realm. And so we do a lot in the way of webinars, blog articles, posting on social media that just tries to help people sometimes get over that initial hump and become comfortable with the technology, and then work with people on how they can continue to learn and actually tailor that kind of an environment for themselves so it benefits them.
All right, so have you got one piece of advice, the most important thing that you think people should know about communicating and networks?
I'd say that the one piece of advice would be to connect with people. don't think about everything as a brand or anything else, but think about the people that you would like to be connected to in real life, and it's no different in an online environment. You just may not meet them until you've been connected with them for a year or two.
Stephen Jubb with the University of New Hampshire, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks for listening to Positive Parenting. You can get more information on today's show and what we're working on in the weeks ahead at MrDad.com. While you're there, visit the MrDad.com gift shop with everything you need to help you become the dad or mom you want to be. Positive Parenting is a production of the MrDad.com radio network. Now, go be a great parent.